Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, TikTok and WeChat are banned from the US starting this Sunday. What does that mean for you if you already have it on your phone? Do you even care? We will talk about it. The weirdest phone of 2020 is possibly the LG Wing, and we have somebody on hand with it to flip us some opinions. Apple launched a bunch of new products this week, including a new Apple Watch Series 6 and SE, a new iPad Air, and an Apple One subscription bundle that actually looks quite interesting. We'll talk about that and how Google could compete. And then the Pixel 5S, what is it? Or at least what was it? And we'll finish with some PlayStation 5 news and what's making us happy. All right. So to join me this week, we have Jerry Hildenbrand. What's going on?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm hanging in there. It's been a week. Joe Maring has also had a week with a lot of reviews. So how are you holding up?
My Fitbit Sense is telling me that I think stressed. Maybe stressed. I'm doing good, but I just know that I'm trying to take care of that a little bit with some guided breathing sessions. So
your body's betraying you. You don't think you're stressed, but your body's telling you otherwise.
Let me teach you what to breathe to help take care of stress.
There you go. Exactly.
And before we get on that topic, Alex Dobie, how are you?
I'm great. It's good to be back. When you were introducing the LG Wing before, I thought you were going to say here to flip everyone off. But
I was trying to. Yeah. I was trying to.
No,
do that.
I'm doing good, and I have the LG Wing in hand. So
we'll flip us off right now. If we had a video,
not literally, but yeah, with the assistance of the LG Wing,
which is interesting because your Skype is blurring your background. So when you flip it in front of your face, it blurs both of it out because it doesn't really know what to do.
That's good because there's a part of this device that we're not allowed to show, so it's good that it's blurring it out for you guys.
Yeah, we'll get into exactly what that is. All right, so let's start with some TikTok WeChat news. This happened today. We're recording Friday, September 18th, and lo and behold, the U.S. government has decided to unilaterally ban both TikTok and WeChat from U.S. app stores starting on Sunday. I will quote, "Today's actions prove once again that President Trump will do everything in his power to guarantee our national security and protect Americans from the threats of the Chinese Communist Party." That is from a press release issued by the State Department, the Department of Commerce. Jerry, walk us through the steps that the U.S. government will take to essentially ban TikTok and WeChat. It's a two-stage process.
Well, first, Jim, our podcast producer, please put like some patriotic music behind Daniel reading that press release.
Please don't. But,
what they're going to do is, first, as of this coming Sunday, it's being yanked from all online app stores, not just Google Play or the App Store, but third-party app stores included. It's just gone. Both apps are being pulled. Later in November, they're going to start regulating, you know, network providers to make sure you can't connect to those apps, you know, even if you did have them installed. And then sometime in the future, I can picture, you know, they're going to come door to door, and if they catch it on your phone, they're going to beat the living daylights out of you. No, that part's
not
true.
You're joking, Jerry, but you probably shouldn't, because that doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility at this point. So let's just be clear. Starting Sunday, you won't be able to download it, but it'll still work if you have it on your phone. So there's going to be a lot of people who have heard about TikTok, may have heard about WeChat. They'll just download it and keep it on their phone just in case they need it. It'll still work until November 12th at least. And after that, there will basically be laws in place or an executive order in place to prohibit ISPs from routing traffic from both TikTok and WeChat. Content delivery networks won't be able to store basically cache data from those services. Cloud networks will not allow to be used to store those images, basically any metadata as well from users. It just, that data will not be stored on US soil. And anybody who contravenes those rules will be, I assume, fined in a large way. So will, like, once September, once November 12th comes around, which ironically is the release date of the PS5. I don't know why I just thought of that, but it is. Will people be able to use a VPN to get around this if they already have it on their phone? Like, how will it work?
Maybe. US-based VPNs, of course, are going to comply with the order. In the EU, they don't have to. They probably won't. But there are plenty of other ways that, you know, it can be blocked. VPNs are not perfect.
If you want to see the ultimate place this could end up in terms of, you know, this game of cat and mouse when services are blocked, then just look at China, right? Look at the hoops that you have to jump through to use services like Twitter, Google, in mainland China. Ultimately, if the US government is really, really serious about blocking any traffic to WeChat, then you need to actually look at the packets at some point. To check things aren't being routed in a certain way. And if you really, really, really want to do that and you want to stop people using foreign VPN services to get around that, then, you know, you get into blocking of those VPN services and it becomes just, it spirals out of control and you end up with a system like they have in China with massive censorship.
And it's also worth remembering, a lot of people said, oh, that's after the election, it doesn't matter. I don't care who wins the election, Donald Trump is still president on November 12th and can sign any executive order he likes.
So I just want to be clear about something, Alex. So there's two important distinctions here. WeChat is a private chat service. Well, among its many features, there is a private chat service. I assume that there is no end-to-end encryption because it is essentially run out of China.
The rules are somewhat different from mainland China accounts versus the rest of world accounts. I'm not sure if there is end-to-end encryption. I'd imagine there probably isn't, given that, you know, the thing is riddled with backdoors anyway.
Right. And there's an understanding that if it does amount to some sort of packet sniffing, that it shouldn't be impossible to find those packets and distinguish them and block them from coming through. Or it's just a matter of, you know, a hard block, right? Anything with that resembles packets from WeChat will be blocked, and it may actually also block a bunch of other services that may come out of China as well that weren't blocked. So we're not really sure how hard this firewall or how tall this firewall is going to be at this point.
And I would bet, at least initially, it will be quite, you know, the barrier of entry to get around it will be quite low, right? It will be relatively easy. Yeah. And I doubt the US government is going to want to get into, you know, trying to interfere in foreign VPN services to you know, really, really, really stop people who want to get access to WeChat from doing so.
Yeah, I do not see the government forcing telecoms to disallow encrypted VPN traffic at the last node so they can inspect and see if it's a TikTok packet. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree.
It will be interesting, like, if they go the route of imposing fines or whatever, or how they're going to track that, because I have a feeling that the people that use TikTok, they're like dead serious on that platform. Cause like, I don't mess with it that much, but I know a lot of people where it's like their go-to instead of Twitter, Instagram or something. And I feel like there'll be a lot of people that don't really regard that and will just do whatever they can to use a VPN to access it in some way. So if they really go for it, it's going to be interesting to see, like, if there is a fine in place, how they're going to go about that, how strict they're going to be about enforcing that, because I feel like a lot of people just aren't going to regard it or care for it and just like still find some way to loop around and use the platform regardless.
Good. And this is my opinion, not Android Central. So don't freak out, Daniel. F the police. If you can get around it, do it.
The executive order here from Wilbur Ross, or it's not an executive order. It's a response to Trump's executive order from back in August 6th. But the Department of Commerce has basically said that there are going to be different routes for banning both of these services. So as of September 20th, neither of them will be on app stores anymore. And then WeChat will no longer be allowed to process payments within the US. So that's starting this Sunday. And then as of September 20th for WeChat and November 12th for TikTok, those are the other prohibitions that we talked about earlier. US ISPs not hosting any traffic, CDNs not caching anything, fines will be imposed. That's as of Sunday for WeChat. but it's only starting in November for TikTok. And it says specifically, the president has provided until November 12th for the national security concerns posed by TikTok to be resolved. If they are, the prohibitions in this order may be lifted. So this is in line with the supposed deal with Oracle that may have some implications on TikTok's ability to stay online in the U.S. past November 12th. Because if Oracle meets the criteria for securely hosting TikTok's data and essentially segmenting it from the rest of the world, this ban may not happen.
And the last part of that that kicks in from September 20th or November 12th is kind of interesting, because my reading of the fourth point is that that is basically, technically, if you run, take a strict reading of it, that's what makes actually using the app illegal.
Yeah.
The use of constituent code of the app.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's how far does that go, right? Like, if you make a video separately in a different video editor, open TikTok, and then just upload it, is that banned?
I mean, opening the app is use of the application's constituent code. If you want to get right down to it.
Yeah, it seems pretty broad.
I'm pretty Stalin-esque to tell developers what code they can and can't use. Sorry, but it does.
There's a lot of, this seems to be kind of a bad faith argument to get TikTok to do exactly what the U.S. government has been asking them to negotiate with public companies, right? Like, we're going to let you try to sell yourself off. We're going to try to let you negotiate with Microsoft and Oracle to get a deal in place. But this order basically tells them, well, you have no choice. We're going to essentially shut down your business until you comply exactly the way that we want you to.
Yeah.
And the deal with Oracle has shades of cronyism, because Larry Ellison is a huge Trump donor, and there's the implication that this deal was sort of like the deal with Microsoft was sort of scuttled because it was made clear to TikTok that any deal with Microsoft wouldn't be approved anyway. So you might as well go with the Oracle option, because that's the only one that the president would allow.
Jerry, do you want to talk about Larry Ellison?
No. the least, the less you mention that man's name, the better. He's evil crook. Again, so, not Android Central's opinion, my own.
This is messy. It'll continue to be messy. I don't think that these dates are... I want to say that this will probably change again between the time you... Like, this is actually going to come out on Sunday, so by the time you hear this, things may have changed between when we're recording this. But I'm guessing that once the ban goes into effect, there will be a scramble to get around it, and traffic for things like how to use TikTok in the U.S., is going to skyrocket, because people, kids especially, are going to try to do their damnedest to find their way around it. Now, after TikTok is banned from app stores, if somebody hasn't downloaded it yet, on iOS, there is really no way to sideload the app, right? But on Android, there will be myriad ways to sideload an APK. You just have to find it. And then between Sunday and November 12th, when ostensibly the app stops working, TikTok should still be as normal, but that could change at any time.
Right. I'm buying a bunch of like iPhone 7s and installing TikTok on it and putting them on eBay. So
that's what people did with Fortnite.
Yeah. It's Flappy Bird as well. Yeah. I do wonder if it is going to be as simple as just you can't get it, or whether there'll be some workaround like changing your app store region. You got to imagine that, the bar would be a little bit higher than that, but it will be interesting to see how things shake out. And certainly the barrier to entry will be higher on iOS versus Android.
Do you need a credit card to, for example, years ago, I was able to create a US App Store account, because at the time, if you only agreed to download free apps, you didn't need a credit card. I don't know if that's still the case, or if Apple requires you to have a credit card.
They require you to have a card on file, because I bought an iPhone SE to play around with iOS, and I was required to give them a card number.
Interesting. So,
but
yeah, I guess what I'm going to do is just go buy a bunch of iPhones, put Canadian App Store accounts on them, and go ship them to people in the US.
Yeah.
Make a ton of money.
You got to do it now before the episode comes out so no one steals your ingenious idea.
It's okay. Canadians aren't that ambitious. I'm pretty much the only one thinking this, I promise. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about the LG Wing. Alex, you have had it for a couple of days. You scrambled to get your hands on out after, what, like 6 hours with the phone or something stupid like that. Walk us through the Explorer project and its first piece of hardware.
Alex, first, can you put it up to the microphone and make it make the noise?
I was going to try and do that, but I'm not sure if the mic will pick it up. So maybe Jim might have to help us a little bit, but it is...
Crank that gain. No, try again.
Yeah, can't really hear. You can, fortunately, what I can show you are the sound effects for opening the LG Wing. So, okay, no, never mind. Can't find the option. Anyway, the LG Wing. So the Explorer project is effectively LG codifying something it's been doing for years, really, which is creating weird phones. It's, you know, making something maybe just because they can, seeing if the idea sticks, and maybe there'll be a second generation like there was with the G Flex series, or maybe it'll just die like the LG G5 and its modules. So the first of these, you could kind of argue the dual screen thing is a little bit of, you know, Explorer project, but the LG Wing is the first device, you know, self-contained device that's part of this project. Obviously, the gimmick is it has this rotating screen. So when you're carrying it around normally, it's closed. It's pretty much just a big chunky smartphone, and it is pretty big and chunky, 260 grams, which is heavier even than the Galaxy S20 Ultra. So it's pretty big. It's pretty thick. LG, you know, has done as much as it can to make it roughly normal smartphone size, but it's still pretty chunky. And what this is all about is, you know, seeing what kind of experiences you can enable when you have this sort of, you know, unusual dynamic, this unusual sort of dual screen setup. And the most obvious thing, right, is watching a video on the main screen. You have this smaller square secondary display that you can, you know, be scrolling through Twitter or, you know, scrolling through Instagram or looking at a website in Chrome, anything like that. But you can also have different kind of interactions. So you can have the main screen in portrait orientation, and then you can have this sort of side screen sticking out where, you know, you could have like you could have a video there, of course, but you could quickly jump between, say, a social app, or you could be reading a book or a website or something on the main screen. Or you could also tip it upside down, and when you do that, you can be, say, you could have your document up on the top screen, and then you have the wide screen down below where you can actually get a pretty decent sort of ergonomic keyboard that's split between the two areas of the landscape orientation display. So there are an awful lot of things you can do there. And LG is also working with some game developers to enable sort of unique experiences. So I think, for example, if you download Asphalt 9, you can have like a map up top while you're actually playing the game on the main screen. So there are a bunch of different things you can do. And of course, the software takes a little bit of time to catch up. You know, Android's built-in multitasking perhaps isn't the greatest for this new and unusual form factor, especially because you will be switching apps quite a lot, and it does take quite a lot of time to sort of get your apps arranged in the right place. And especially remember, you know, the main screen you can split in two as well, so you can potentially have up to three full screen apps at once and a bunch of windowed apps. So it's an interesting experiment from LG. The most sort of interesting takeaway from the event, I think, is that this isn't going to be the only device like this that we see, and LG does have new you know, successors to this lined up. We saw sort of like a slider device teased at the end of that presentation, and to me, I think that might even work a little bit better for the way I'm using this than the LG Wing does.
That's my biggest question, is the software. LG's never been known for its software on a single screen device. How does the dual screen interaction fare? And do you see potential for it if developers really catch on to this idea and at least put in the minimum amount of effort to optimize for both screens?
Basically, no. I think this is the first device in the series. I think this one is just too weird to really catch on the big way. And of course, that means that developer interest isn't going to be there unless there's a lot of money on the table from LG. So, if you are a developer looking to get into dual screen stuff, you know, maybe you'd be interested in something like the LG dual screen add-on, because, you know, it's much cheaper. You know, people are more interested in getting a regular LG phone, and okay, of course it has this add-on as well. And I think that if there is going to be more interest in an LG style, you know, convertible, it'll be a you know, like a slider style phone that we end up getting. If you imagine sort of you know, BlackBerry Priv kind of deal, but the keyboard is actually just a second display. I see that being quite interesting, and I'd be really interested to use that. But in the meantime, we have the LG Wing, and it's just a little bit too weird for most people, I think.
I just want to know if you can put TikTok videos on the main screen and then chat through WeChat on the little side screen.
Yeah, you can get, yeah. You can for the next 48 hours anyway.
So let's talk about the gimbal feature, because it's interesting. It's using a bunch of sensors on a dedicated ultra-wide camera. It crops in quite significantly, as far as I can tell. And then you can use a joystick on the bottom screen to move around and basically imitate a proper gimbal. How does it work in reality?
The first sign that, you know, that this has some compromises, when you first start it up, it tells you it works best in areas of in areas with a lot of light. So obviously this isn't going to be great if, you know, even in dark, dimly lit indoor conditions. It works fine. I mean, the smoothness of panning is really, really good. This is a feature that allows you to basically hold the phone in portrait orientation. And because of the orientation of that ultra wide sensor, lets you then basically crop within that region. And, you know, because the sensor's on board, you have this smooth panning and also really good stabilization. Works you know, well enough. I'm not really the kind of person that would use this feature a lot. And I do think there are quite a lot of compromises there in terms of low light performance as well. So it's an interesting experiment. Whether it'll really take off, I don't know, or whether it, you know, it'll just be sort of consigned to the, you know, whatever basement that things like, you know, previous LG video modes that we've had go to. I'm not sure, but it's perfectly fine for what it does. It works well enough, but I'm not sure it's really a killer app for this phone.
All right, so when it comes out, it'll be under $1,000. We don't know exactly the price. It won't be available unlocked in the US because LG, but presumably this has a very similar marketing trajectory to the Velvet, except it's not going to be nearly as mainstream. One of my carrier sources tipped me to the fact that LG is running TV spots for the Velvet for the first time in 4 years, that they haven't done anything on US domestic cable since the G6, I want to say. What they're trying to do is really recapture some of the mainstream interest in their phones with something like the Velvet, which is a 5G phone that's significantly cheaper than anything from Samsung. Where do you think the Wing fits into that? Does it at all fit into the company's kind of mainstream narrative? Do you think anybody is going to be buying this, or is it really just for people who want folding phones but don't want to spend $2,000?
It's a little bit of the latter. I think, you know, you could, if you're perhaps in the market for a little bit of an expensive, unusual phone, but you don't want to stump up $2,000 for Galaxy Z Flip 2, then I could see you maybe going for this. Other than that, I think it's basically just a halo effect, right? It's the same thing as the Galaxy Z series has for Samsung. You maybe, you know, get interested in LG by looking at something like the Wing, but then ultimately go and buy a Velvet because it's basically the same internals, that it's about $500 cheaper.
And from what you can tell, is it powerful enough to really do everything that LG wants it to do to power two screens?
It works about as well as the Velvet. I think it's a big part of what makes it feel less fast than a lot of, you know, flagship phones in the $1,000 plus area is the refresh rate of the screen, right? 60 hertz. It's always a bit rough going back to that after you've used a higher refresh rate display. And of course, because you wouldn't necessarily expect a high refresh rate because, you know, they're two screens, the graphical power to do that perhaps isn't there. It works well enough. There's a decent amount of power. It works, you know, I haven't noticed any additional, you know, battery drain or lack of performance when I've used it in the opened out position. It's more that, you know, 60 hertz and a Snapdragon 765G, you know, with LG's UI on top of it, isn't the most responsive Android experience. But it's also, you know, it's not terrible. It's usable.
All right. So final thoughts on it. What do you think? Plus or minus, yay or nay?
I don't want to sort of prejudice our review, and this is a pre-production unit, of course. I would say mostly nay for the phone itself, but yay for the direction that LG is going, and possibly yay for this more sort of traditional slider design that might be emerging some point in the future.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have a full review for it at some point, I guess, when we have final hardware, and we'll have you back on to talk about it because cool. I'm interested in it. And what's really interesting about it is that a lot of the comments that I've seen across the board on YouTube, on our site, on other sites, they're all fairly optimistic about this form factor. A lot of people are like, I don't want a folding phone. The Duo's too big. The Fold is too, you know, fragile. This actually hits both of those points, but without really a massive, you know, price bump over a regular phone, and it doesn't feel quite as vulnerable to like breaking whenever you pick it up.
Something worth mentioning before we touch off is that's one big thing this has that of a foldable like you know, the Samsung foldables does not. This has water resistance. Okay, it's only IP54, and it also has the mil-spec stuff that LG's you know, regular phones also have. So this doesn't strike me as a fragile phone. I don't feel like I have to baby this when it's out and about in my pocket.
I would say that it's the first time a folding phone has been given an IP rating, but a lot of people would argue it's not a folding phone, and some people would say that the new Razr is actually water resistant because that's what Motorola claims. Even though it doesn't have an IP rating, they apply some nano resistant coating to all of the internals to prevent it from getting destroyed. But we wouldn't know because Motorola refuses to distribute review units for that thing, as Joe and I have been told many times by Motorola's PR.
We can go buy one. Oh,
man. What a shit show. All right, let's move on and talk about the Apple announcement. So Joe, as the resident Apple fan in the room, we'll go to you. Apple announced the Apple Watch Series 6 and SE to replace the Series 5. The Series 3 is staying on board at its $199 price, but the SE will be $279. The Series 6 will be $399. We are currently reviewing the Fitbit Sense, which will debut next Friday, I think, a week from today, for $330. So not quite as expensive as the Series 6, but more so than the SE, and it comes with its own set of compromises. So before we go to the tablet side, what do you think of the Apple Watch Series 6? Obviously, the major announcement is that it has a blood oxygen sensor on the back where it lets you get your SpO2 levels after 15 seconds. The Fitbit Sense does it, but it does it in a really different way. You have to be sleeping to get your SpO2 percentage, but that could also be better because it's taking multiple readings throughout the night. And obviously, with the Apple Watch, the year-over-year upgrades are going to be less and less because so many of the major improvements happened with Series 2 and 3, right? All of the Apple Watches have GPS. All of them are water-resistant. All of them have the big OLED display. All of them, you know, cellular, whatever. So what do you think when you first saw the Series 6?
I mean, it's not, like, overly exciting, and I don't think I expected it to be, just because like they have this form factor, they have this foundation that like clearly works. They're not going to pivot away from that anytime soon, I don't think, because that would, if they, like, I think when this was coming out, there were some people that were maybe hoping for like a circular design or some radical shift for it. But I don't think if we ever see that, it's going to be a long time before we do, just because that's going to introduce a whole different form factor and the F word, the fragmentation word that Apple doesn't really like to mess with. So I think it's not like an exciting or thrilling upgrade, but it makes sense given where Apple Watch is and how far ahead it is for the iPhone ecosystem. The big upgrades, like you said, there's the SpO2 sensor for those that are interested in it, which makes a lot of sense given how much Apple pushes this for health tracking, and like that's kind of become the big focus for it. The always-on display gets a bit brighter. I think that's about 2.5 times what you got on the Series 5. And, of course, their system on a chip is faster than the one on Series 5, which is already probably the fastest you could get for any smartwatch. So it's just building upon that foundation, which is already like darn near perfect as far as smartwatches are in 2020. I think people that maybe have like a Series 3 or a Series 2, it's an easy upgrade for anyone holding on to one of those watches. I personally rock a Series 4 because I have an iPhone with my Android phone. And as someone that has a Series 4 or Series 5, there's no real need to upgrade just because it's same designs. Those watches are still plenty fast enough. I think for me, the most interesting is the Apple Watch SE because that $279 price point is kind of fantastic. You're getting the design they introduced with Series 4, the faster chip than what's on a Series 3 or an older Apple Watch. And you miss out on like the ECG and the SpO2 sensors and some of those more high-end health-focused things. But Apple kind of has two distinct models now. If you want just the basic Apple Watch experience with the upgraded display and the fast processing tech for basic fitness tracking and notifications, you've got that for $279. And then if you want to go all the way and really focus on health and some of those higher-end features, $399 is still a decent price given everything it does. Apple Watch has kind of always been the go-to if you have an iPhone. I think that just kind of solidifies it. Like, these aren't changing the game, but it's just making it more accessible with the SE model and adding a couple new features here and there for people that want the highest-end version, but maybe coming for something that's a few years old at this point.
Oh, so it was pointed out to me yesterday that the newest Honor Band, I don't know if it's the 4 or 5 or 6, has all of those same features.
That the Apple Watch does.
Yeah, that the new Apple Watch does. So I looked on Amazon, it's $70. Just saying.
I would not give the same level of... I wouldn't trust the sensors and the Honor Band.
I wouldn't trust the sensors in an Apple Watch either. I mean, my doctor has told me not to trust them.
Well, I mean, you're not alone there, right? Like, there are a lot of levels of trust with these consumer, you know, these consumer grade sensors, right? And former editor Andrew Martinick came out on Twitter the other day after the Apple Watch announcement saying, hey, look, Apple's really focusing on health with the Apple, you know, Fitness Plus and with all these new sensors. But in reality, if you use an Apple Watch to track your health and your workouts, you're doing yourself a disservice because Garmin is really the gold standard here. And they've been working on the accuracy of these sensors for years. And that's why people pay a premium for them.
Yeah.
I don't know the Honor Band. It's probably a decent product. And, you know, the fact that it has all of these sensors in it for $80 is pretty amazing. But I would guarantee you that most Apple users, iPhone users, are not really going to trust an Honor product on their wrist over an Apple Watch.
Well, yeah, and not even the trust so much, but I think just if you have an iPhone, you have an Apple Watch, the fact that you can have that wearable that's going to put all of your information into the activity app, but now it's the Apple Fitness app and Apple Health. You're not going to a third-party service like the Fitbit app, or if Honor has their own fitness tracking thing. Like, it's all going to that same place, and it's all keeping you in that ecosystem, and that's the bread and butter of what Apple does with these products. It may not be the most accurate or so, but it's going to give you all that information and all those features and put it in a place that you're already familiar with and an application that you already use and you already know how to work it.
Let's talk about the Fitbit Sense a little bit, because it is, especially at its price point, it's become the Apple Watch's main competitor in many ways, right? Android, you know, there's the Galaxy Watch and Galaxy Watch Active series. We reviewed the Watch 3. It's great. But the fitness tracking on that isn't awesome. It has its problems. It's not accurate. The app ecosystem on the Galaxy Watch is basically non-existent, and yet using it is a pleasure, right? The UI is very good. The fluidity of everything, the notification UX is actually better than I find on the Apple Watch. What's your take on where the Sense and the Galaxy Watch fit in against the Apple Watch Series 6?
I haven't used one of those third-party watches with an iPhone, but like the Fitbit has
for Android, right? Like let's bring it back to just talking about like the products themselves, right? Obviously the Apple Watch doesn't work on Android, but just apples to apples, how do they compare?
I mean, like Fitbit, like from a fitness point of view, I mean, like that's the go-to if you want like robust health and fitness tracking. Like they've kind of established their name in that space for a few years now. People know the Fitbit name. they're trying to delve into the notification side, the smartwatch side of thing a bit more with like the Sense and their Versa series. I'd argue if you're looking for kind of like the whole smartwatch experience, Samsung has kind of owned that field a little bit, and they're also involved with the health side of things with their Galaxy or Samsung Health Suite. From what I've used of both of them, I would probably say that with like the Galaxy Watch, you're getting kind of more of a similar Apple Watch experience where it's a decent mix of the health and the notification side of things. But Fitbit has been trying some neat things and pushing the needle a bit more with kind of like holistic health and more robust health tracking outside of just like tracking your steps and your activity throughout the day.
So Jerry, just, you know, you kind of did a tongue-in-cheek tweet after the Apple Watch announcement linking to a pulse oximeter on Amazon for like $20. Yeah. But tell me how accurate these consumer grade sensors are compared to their dedicated kind of medical grade counterparts.
The little pulse oximeter I listed on Amazon is what most, you know, ER nurses use. There are very, very, you know, accurate devices on carts on wheels that they can roll in if they need an extremely precise measurement. But, you know, oxygen saturation in your blood, it's one of those things, if it's under a certain percent, there's a problem. And there's a little bit of wiggle room, so these cheap sensors are good enough. EKG, no, cheap sensors aren't good enough. Heart rate, they're probably good enough as long as they're consistent. Because, you know, your heart rate, you don't need to know an exact number. You just need to know what you need to do to elevate it for exercise and what it is at rest. And it gives you the same number every time. That's good enough. Your doctor can do any measurements if he needs a precise thing. And I made a joke earlier, but for consumer grade devices, unless you have health issues, you can probably trust this stuff, especially if it's something like Apple Health, where you can export the data for your doctor to look at. I would trust them. I was just making a joke.
So it's better than nothing, but it's right. Certainly not as good as having a dedicated sensor. I think that will be true. That was true a few years ago when they debuted, yeah. And it's probably going to be true indefinitely.
Yep.
But the confluence of these sensors is really what I find quite impressive, right? The fact that you're getting 6, 7, 10 sensors on the back of one wearable is what I find interesting, yep. Both about the Apple Watch and the Fitbit Sense, right? The Sense can do electrodermal measurements, so it can check your skin temperature. It can do SpO2. It can do ECG pending FDA approval,
yeah.
Outside the U.S. It can obviously do heart rate variability. It can do, you know, low and high heart rate alerts. It can do all these things, which is the holistic part of it is not clear to me yet. And Joe can probably back me up on this. There's this sort of EDA scan feature where it uses a combination of readings, both of your skin temperature, your heart rate, your heart rate variability, to check for stress. And it's sort of like, hey, you're stressed. You should take a moment. Everybody's stressed right now. You know, this is
partnered with,
it doesn't goop. Feel like a meaningful measure.
Yeah, that's just dumb.
Stressed is the default setting for most people these days.
Yeah, I've tried messing around with it a bit. And the way you do it on the Sense is you hold your palm over like the entire screen, and it's a 2-minute test where it just asks you to like stay completely still, like monitor your breathing, just don't move for 2 minutes, keep your hand on the watch, and then it gives you your stress management score for the day, and you can log if you're feeling calm, if you're feeling anxious or stressed, and you can log those feelings throughout the day. I had an 88 score on Thursday, I have an 87 score today, and I don't really know what that means. I don't know if that means I'm stressed beyond belief, or if I'm apparently doing good.
I have an 89, Joe, so maybe I feel very stressed, but apparently I'm less stressed than you are.
Yeah, like I appreciate that they're trying to tackle this, the whole subject of like mental health, and make this something where it is accessible, like, and it's okay to talk about this, and it's okay to like be conscious of it and try to monitor it in some way. I don't know the long-term value, though. Like, I've messed with the sensor a couple times. It's interesting to see, like, a number of where it thinks I'm at. But I don't know, like, where you go beyond that. Like, if you use this just to kind of have it as, like, as something where you want to track it just because it's there and it's interesting, or if you want to use it as, like, a serious tool for monitoring your stress and, like, actually using it as a legit thing where you're using that to gauge your mental health.
Oh, please don't.
No, yeah, that's where I get a little uncomfortable with it. It's like, I want, like, not just Fitbit, but other companies, as they try to approach these, the stress management and the mental side of things, like, make it clear to people that this is, like, a supplemental thing. This is not a replacement for, like, therapy or other ways to effectively and properly, like, manage that and address those kind of issues you might have.
Yeah, that scares me, because the people that could legitimately benefit the most from something like that should never be relying on a $200 smartwatch to let them know that, oh yeah, these thoughts and feelings you're having, you're just fine. Go ahead and do whatever impulses you're feeling, because that's scary.
And to Fitbit's credit, they haven't, like said in any of their marketing that, like, this is a replacement for therapy or any, like, medication or anything. They're just doing it as a way to, like, add the feature, I think, make it a talking point. But there's just the worry I have that some people could use this and think it's a replacement for those things. Yep. And there's a gray area there that I think we're going to see a lot more of with this whole holistic health push that we have with Ascense and what Amazon's doing with their Halo tracker. It's going to be an interesting transition as these companies try to move beyond the basic step tracking and exercise activity monitoring and try to go to these new areas where I think there could be some repercussions that are just naturally going to come with these new sensors and everything.
All right. To move things along, I want to talk quickly about the new tablets that came out from Apple and Samsung. Well, coming out on Apple's side. So Apple, in addition to the watches, announced a new iPad 8th generation, which is out today. It's basically what you expect. It's the iPad for most people. It's still got the bezels, the home button. It's fine. The more interesting announcement was the new iPad Air. It starts at $599. It basically takes a lot of the features of the iPad Pro, but omits the ProMotion display, so no 120 hertz. It doesn't have the quad speakers. The screen doesn't get quite as bright. I forget a couple of other things. It doesn't have Face ID. It integrates the biometrics into the power button, which is exactly what Samsung does on the Galaxy Tab S7. And, you know, this is the debut of the new 5-nanometer chip that will inevitably come to the iPhone 12 series later this year. So, Jerry, you wrote a piece to kind of complement Joe's Galaxy Tab S7 review titled "The New iPad Air Reminds Us Just How Bad Most Android Tablets Really Are." And your focus was mainly about the lack of apps. But, yes, you know, Apple obviously has tremendous success with the iPad, and it's not just about the apps. Let's talk a little bit about the iPad Air itself and why it's a big deal for Apple, and then move into why the app deficit is so stark.
The iPad Air, Apple may frame it differently, but the iPad Air is the iPad you want. It's cheaper. It's fast. You might want Face ID so you can play with animated emojis and stuff, but it's got a fingerprint sensor, so you don't have to worry about not putting a password on it. And you're not going to be using this thing at the beach, you know, 90% of the time. You're going to be using it inside. The screen doesn't have to get any brighter, and you're saving money for something that's going to be just as fast. I think if you're in the market for a new tablet today, and you're not so entrenched in Amazon that you can't understand anything besides Amazon Prime, you should buy an iPad Air. I hate that saying that, but that's what I think. That's probably the best announcement on the iPad line that Apple's had in a couple years.
Plus, they moved to USB-C, which is really nice.
Oh, yeah. You know, for us, that's nice. For most people, they don't care. It looks like a very, very nice product. And Apple has done everything they can do and everything they need to do to make sure there's a wealth of great apps to put on it.
All right, so we'll come back to the app question in a sec, because I want Joe to chime in here. You reviewed the Tab S7 today, It's a good tablet. You actually said it's the best Android tablet for most people and gave it a 4-star review, but it also has a lot of bugs, a lot of problems, and Dex just is not a fully baked feature, which I want you to get into in a sec. But you actually use an iPad as your primary computer throughout the day, an iPad Pro. So what was your impression of the iPad Air as sort of a computer, if you want to call it that, and how it compares to the Pro, and like what Apple's strategy is by making the Air so much closer to the Pro than people may have thought was possible?
I think if this had been out before I got my iPad Pro, like it might have been the iPad I got, just because it's so much cheaper than those Pro models, and the fact that they have the same quote-unquote all-screen design on there is really impressive. Like, the biggest drawback, obviously, like, it's not 120 hertz, it's only 60 hertz, which I would argue isn't as big of a deal on iOS compared to Android, just because of how Apple handles certain animations and things. But, like, not to be the Apple shill or the Apple sellout, but it is really hard to find, like, something to really complain about or to really be mad at with the machine, just because it gives you that the iPad ecosystem or the Apple ecosystem, which, like, I would say objectively, like, has the better app support, has the better features there if you're using a mobile operating system on that big screen. It's got the A14 Bionic, which is going to be more than fast enough for regular consumer use, and plenty fast if you're going to do video editing or photo editing or anything along those lines. And that $599 price, like, of course, you have to factor in, like, the Apple Pencil and the keyboard if you want to really take advantage of some of those features, but it is hard to find, like, a bone to pick with it, just because for the price and the specs and the features, it's a really compelling option for anyone that is in the Apple ecosystem, or if you're just looking for kind of a touchscreen device that is versatile for tablet or laptop use that's not ungodly expensive the way some of those pro model configurations can be.
Yeah. So $599, it comes out in October, so we haven't actually used it yet, but I'm curious. I'm very curious about it, especially given the fact that, you know, it doesn't compromise nearly as much as I thought it would over the Pro. And as somebody, I like the iPad Pro. I've used it a lot. I have the 12.9-inch version. And yeah, I don't see myself going, like, missing much about the Air if I were to change to it. What I am interested in is, so today the Galaxy Tab S7 and S7 Plus are out. They are expensive, $699 and $899 respectively. Hayato is reviewing the 7 Plus for us, which has the 12.2-inch OLED display, which is incredible. But this is a really powerful tablet, right, Joe? Like, Snapdragon 865 Plus, it can come up with, you know, 8 gigs of RAM. This is a very, very powerful device if you pair it with a keyboard case and you know, Dex, if you find a way to use it properly. So what was it like using it as a computer, as a laptop replacement?
It's interesting. Samsung has their Dex interface, which you can run directly on it, which for people that haven't used it, which is probably quite likely, it effectively turns Android into something that looks a lot like Windows. So you have apps you can open in resizable windows. You've got kind of an app drawer that looks a lot like what it does in Chrome OS. All your quick settings are moved to the lower right corner, and it's effectively like a traditional desktop operating system. The idea of it is what I think like Android needs if it's going to be successful on a tablet, because it ditches the stretched out phone UI for something that actually accommodates and makes use of that larger real estate. When you find apps that you can run on resizable windows that actually let you resize them and they can expand into full-size apps that, if you want to take advantage of the full screen and run other apps on top of them, it can be an experience that, like, you can see the potential of what's there, but then you open certain apps that are completely stuck to a certain size window that you can't make smaller or make bigger at all, or there are other apps that just refuse to run in the Dex mode, and that's where you see the problems of Samsung kind of taking it upon itself to patch up Android and force it to work on a tablet when, like, at its core, Google has, like, its own issues it needs to address with app compatibility and making Android, like, on its own run well on a tablet without Samsung coming in, forcing its own software on it, and then ultimately you get these weird quirks and bugs when it's trying to do all this on top of a platform that wasn't designed to run as a desktop setup like this. So like the potential is fascinating. When everything works, like it can be more effective or more productive than what you get with iPadOS, but the place of where it's at right now with apps not resizing or apps refusing to run and using just the jankiness, I guess, that kind of exists still, it unfortunately puts a damper for me at least on the potential of what could be if this was fully fleshed out and fully backed by Google or something.
So Jerry, I just want to ask quickly, what is the limit, like how much work does it take to make an Android app resizable, right? Every Android app that works in portrait mode on a phone technically should be usable in DeX in windowed mode, but some of them just don't work or work really badly. What does it take from a development perspective to actually take advantage of free form mode on Android?
If you're writing a new app today, it really not much. But most apps aren't new today. As of today, they've been around for a long time, and they were written before Google provided easy tools to adjust the layout on the fly. So your best case scenario is a full window, big screen app, you know, on a tablet or a Chromebook or in DeX, and everything's crammed up into one corner, which, you know, that's the good experience. The bad experience is it's like, oh, hey, I don't recognize this resolution. I'm just not going to run. These are the same problems that plague Chromebooks. Whereas, you know, Google can tell you that, you know, a million apps are compatible, and they are compatible. They'll turn on. They just don't work as expected. And if they do work, it just looks terrible.
Right. Okay. So TLDR, if you're using a relatively new app, it should work fine. If not, then you may be out of luck. So try to find a newer alternative.
Yeah. All right. And outside of the software bugs, like, it's $650 for the base model for the Tab S7, and you're getting the S Pen included with it. So, like, if those kind of the software bugs and the app compatibility doesn't bother you, like, this is a really good value if you want something for like content consumption, or if you want a device that you can draw or take notes because it has that same 9 millisecond latency of the S Pen from the Note 20 Ultra. Like, the value there from the S Pen and the specs is really nice. It's just whether or not you can put up with some of those quirks that Android still has in a form factor like this.
It's worth pointing out, though, that the Tab S7's keyboard case is $200,
yeah,
which is insane. So yeah, you get an S Pen, but to make this into a laptop that is very like specifically designed for the Tab S7, it's an extra $200. So that's $850. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not cheap. It's significantly more expensive than the iPad Air. I don't know if it's worth it, but if you buy the $70, you know, folio case, you buy your own Bluetooth keyboard and mouse, you'll be fine. It's way less money. So we have a list of cases if you're interested on the site.
Logitech makes a keyboard with a slot that'll hold your tablet right in place, right on top of the keyboard. So
I don't think it's out yet, but it's coming. It's coming. All right, I want to talk quickly about Apple One and compare it to kind of this Google One or what Google One could be. Apple One is coming later this year. It's going to have three tiers of bundle, depending on how many services you want. So you'll be able to combine Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, Apple Arcade, and 50 gigs of iCloud storage for $15 a month. For families, you get the same plus 200 gigs of iCloud for $20 a month, and can be shared with six family members. And then the Premier, which is what I think most people are going to use if they are really into Apple services, is all of the above plus Apple News Plus and Apple Fitness Plus, which we didn't really talk about, and two terabytes of iCloud storage for $30 a month. Alex, when you saw this, was your first take, like mine was, Google needs to get on this right now?
Yeah, but at the same time, I think when you're talking about ecosystems, Apple kind of can and does play by its own rules, right? So, you know, you could look at what's offered the various tiers and say it either is or isn't competitive with what Google may or may not have. But, you know, it's kind of any comparison is kind of moot when you're talking about the Apple ecosystem, because the draw is that, you know, you already have a bunch of Apple stuff, and therefore you're probably not even considering any of the other experiences if out there if you're in the market for this kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, and we don't know you don't know how good Fitness Plus will be, whether it's worth the $10 a month that Apple is claiming it is. If you don't get anything out of, say, Apple TV Plus, you have no choice. You can't unbundle it. Apple Music, for example, is bundled into every one of them. So, and Apple Arcade, it's like $5 a month, but a lot of people that I know that are very into iOS gaming do not touch Apple Arcade just because the types of apps that tend to be on it are not the kinds of apps that they play. So, you know, if you don't get a ton of value from those four services, you're unlikely to buy the premier one, which bundles News Plus and Fitness Plus, plus the extra iCloud storage. So,
and also, I think Google is under a lot more sort of, has a lot more regulatory attention on it in terms of antitrust and stuff like that. So if you want to look at bundling of services together and look at maybe why Google isn't doing that, or perhaps is being careful with what it might be doing, that's possibly a factor there as well. You know, Apple, for everything that it has going on, you know, it doesn't, the regulators are looking at different areas of Apple, such as the App Store, not necessarily the way it's bundling services in.
But I think the irony there is that if Google were to do this for a paid bundle, there would be a lot less regulatory scrutiny on them because they would be charging money for these services, right? Rather than bundling them together for free and forcing OEMs to comply. Ara wrote something on the site the other day that I want to touch on. The title is 5 Ways Google Could Beat Apple One at Its Own Game with a Better Google One Bundle. And, you know, she talks about the services that Google currently charges for, YouTube Premium, Stadia, Play Pass. That is an obvious combination, right? In a $20 bundle, you save $5 a month just with, you know, if say you pay for Stadia $10 a month, you play for Play Pass, I forget what that is, $5 or $6 a month, and you pay for Premium, you also, that's $10 a month. So $20 for all of that, you save $5. That's an easy one. Google could also put Family Link in Google One and really expand that, and I don't know, make G Suite something that normal people could subscribe to and get the benefits of that. She also talks about bundling YouTube TV into something that resembles a value bundle, which is interesting. YouTube TV famously increased its price by like $20 in the last time it increased, so that could offset some of those price increases, and, you know, just be able to launch an umbrella service that has basically everything Google offers. And then the last thing which was interesting was just like offer multi-subscription discounts. So if you subscribe to 2 Google services, you get 15% off, 3 subscriptions, 20% off, etc. That's actually a really fascinating way to approach it. I don't think Google would ever do that, but I like all of these ideas. So let's talk a little bit about that. Joe, what do you think? Is this something that that you would be interested in if Google did launch something like this?
I think so, for sure. Like I've messed around with YouTube TV a bit, and I really like the interface in that compared to like Sling and AT&T's internet TV service. But like those price hikes are just kind of really difficult to justify and keep paying what $70 a month or whatever that costs these days. So like between that, YouTube Music, YouTube Premium, like just the YouTube brand alone, there's a lot they could do there that's really interesting. So like I'm kind of surprised at this point we haven't seen a YouTube Ultimate bundle or something that houses all those services, just because that's been like the go-to brand for Google for their obviously YouTube and music streaming and TV. So that alone I think would be really interesting, like from my perspective. But like when you factor in Play Pass and paid Google One / Google Drive storage, like there's so many avenues they could go with. And I think especially now with these Apple One bundles, like they kind of have to have some response to what's going on now.
I don't think they can. Google just can't negotiate the way Apple can. Google lets the music industry dictate the price of its streaming service for music. They let the television and movie and entertainment industry set the rules for their streaming, you know, Google Play Music and videos and YouTube TV. YouTube just sucks at negotiating. or Google just sucks at, well, YouTube does too, but Google sucks at negotiating. They never, remember when Google Play Music first came out, how artists would just randomly disappear for months at a time and then their stuff would come back. And that was all contract disputes and negotiations, and Google's just bad at that.
That is true. That has been historically accurate. So I don't understand it, given it's one of the biggest companies in the world. But then again, entertainment has never been a strong suit. So let us take a break, and we will come back and talk about the Pixel 5S, or whatever the hell it was going to be. We'll be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Indeed. One of the greatest challenges we all face is taking all the information that's available and knowing where to focus. It's that same problem we run into with hiring too. But with Indeed, you have access to the largest pool of talent and can hire the right people fast. Indeed.com is the number one job site in the world because Indeed gets you the best people fast. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You pay only for what you need. You can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. Plus, Indeed provides powerful tools to make your search that much easier, like sponsored jobs, which are known to be 3.5 times more likely to result in a hire. With 73% of online job seekers visiting Indeed each month, Indeed is going to get you the important hire you need, just like they have for over 3 million businesses. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/ACP. This is their best offer anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/ACP. Terms and conditions apply. Offer valid through September 30th. So, Alex Dobie, you blew up the internet last Sunday when you wrote about the Pixel 5S, or whatever it was going to be called. We're not really sure. You know pretty confidently what it is, but we saw a leak of something called the Pixel 5S. Walk us through what it is, what it was, and why it changed.
Okay, so yeah, this goes back to a couple of weeks ago, and I think some more pictures have leaked this week of a device looking a lot like a Pixel 4a with smaller bezels and an about screen showing not only the name is Pixel 5s, but also the model is Pixel 5s. Of course, that's important because you can change the device name to whatever you want, right? So obviously, there was a device at some point that looked a lot like what we're expecting the Pixel 5 to look like, except the name was Pixel 5s. And of course, because of Apple's use of the S branding, you know, immediately what you might think of is, oh, it's a more premium version of the Pixel 5, right? Maybe it's the new brand for an XL or whatever, something like that. But there are clues as to what's actually going on with this device in those photos. First clue is it's quite an old device. It's an EVT units evaluation. Jerry, remind me, EVT? Evaluation, engineering validation testing, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, so this is one of the earlier stages of development. There are two stages after that. And basically what that means is it's out there so people can test it. They can iron out bugs in the hardware before it advances to the later stages of development. And we also know that it's an old device because it has Android R on it. Around the beta stage, I think in May, it changed to being officially numbered Android 11 when they lock in some more of the APIs. So we know it's an old device. We also know it's called Pixel 5S. And independently of that, we'd also heard that the names that we're getting for the two late 2020 Pixels had changed through the course of development. Specifically, we heard that the device we're now getting as Pixel 4a 5G was originally Pixel 5, and the plan was to give a new name to, you know, the smaller and more premium Pixel to say, okay, this isn't an XL, but it's like Pixel 5, you know, Pro or whatever. And from that, we can kind of come up with the conclusion that probably this is just a Pixel 5. It's the same device that we're going to get later in the year as the smaller and more premium Pixel, codenamed Redfin. So that was the original name for Redfin, Pixel 5S. And the other one, which will ship as Pixel 4a 5G, was originally Pixel 5. So that's that's the secret. It's not the device itself isn't particularly interesting beyond just being an early testing sample of the device we will come to know as the Pixel 5. But it's just interesting that we, you know, until recently, Google had some quite different branding in the works for these two devices.
Yeah, when the Foray was released, I know Google didn't come right out and say it, but they let us, you know, gave us enough clues to know that the 4A 5G and the Pixel 5 is what's coming later. And okay, what happened to this other device that people have seen and talked about? Nobody knows. So you did a good job, Alex.
Yeah, it's just like there's so much BS that clearly happened at Google after the failure of the Pixel 4s to catch on and to sell. We know that Rick Osterloh, from an article released earlier this year, you know, internally he was very upset at the performance of the Pixel 4, specifically the battery life. The Pixel 4a has been great on battery, presumably given the leaked specs of the Pixel 5 with a 4,000 milliamp hour battery. That shouldn't be a problem there either, running a Snapdragon 765G. So it's just interesting that now we're getting close to the launch date. Google confirmed in September 30th launch event where it called out the Pixels, a new Chromecast, and a Nest, a Nest device, which we assume is the new Nest speaker that was leaked earlier this year. So when it all is said and done, right, Alex, the event comes, Google says, hey, there's the Pixel 5, there's the Pixel 4a 5G. What do they tell people, right? What do they tell people about why they made the decision to not build sort of a tier one flagship this year? Or do they just ignore it and just announce these phones as, you know, the new Pixels for a new era or something like that?
I think there has to be some sort of marketing or PR line about why there is this change of direction, right? And I think they're probably, you know, if Google has any sense, there'll be interviews around that at the time where these devices go on sale. I think probably the presentation, as far as phones are concerned, will be more about, okay, here are affordable 5G phones, and by affordable, intelligent 5G phones, so it's all about the faster network connection, and by the way, we're Google, so we can put all this crazy stuff in and still hit this low price point. The more interesting thing for me, and this is a thing people haven't really talked much about, is we've seen the Pixel Neural Core develop over the past few years. In the Pixel 4, a lot of stuff was offloaded to that, right, like the Notes app. I'm wondering if perhaps part of the reasoning behind the move to, you know, a mid to high end tier CPU is going to be that, okay, we're Google, we have our own chip to make the AI magic happen. We don't necessarily need to stump up for a massively powerful SoC because we have this stuff which we've developed ourselves.
Yeah, and that was actually part of one of the more interesting parts of the conversation that The Verge had with former Pixel camera lead Mark Lavoie, who's now at Adobe. They interviewed him last week for the interview show. It's pretty good. You should go listen to it. But what Lavoie said was that, you know, there is so much that Google does in software that it really doesn't focus on hardware at all. And we know based on leaks that this year it'll probably still have the same, you know, what is it, Exmor 363 sensor, right? The same one they've used since the Pixel 2. So this is 3 years of basically identical camera hardware. Good. And yet year over year camera quality seems to be improving. Google is the only company that can really do that. And the question is, when they make the decision to put the same camera hardware in a phone year after year, they are betting on year-over-year software improvement to make up the difference rather than a company like Samsung, which is clearly brute-forcing their way out of the problem.
Yeah, and that's always been the Google way, right? You can tell that Google's efforts haven't been to work with Sony and have them make a crazy new sensor like, say, you know, BBK or Huawei might have done. It's always been about what can they do with the output from that sensor? You know, Google, and I think this was mentioned in the interview as well, Google clearly made the determination that there's only so far you get with these iterative yearly updates to sensors, and actually there's much more to be done to improve image quality on the processing side.
The results don't lie. Yeah, the Pixel 2 is still one of the best camera phones you can buy.
I think there is one area where that doesn't quite apply, though, and there are some things that you just need another lens to do, right? The obvious one is telephoto. You know, however good the Pixel 5's camera is, you are never going to be able to take as impressive zoom shots as, say, for, you know, Oppo Find X2 Pro or Huawei P40 Pro Plus. There are some, you know, eventually Google's just going to have to bite the bullet and just add more cameras to the thing because there's no other way. But yeah, certainly for your standard smartphone camera, absolutely stands up next to any of today's flagships.
Anything else you want to talk about? I'm kind of curious about this new Sabrina Chromecast, the Apple TV dongle. Rumor has it that, you know, today actually, as we're talking, there was a new leak from WinFuture where we actually see the dongle now. It's pretty nondescript. It looks just like a white Google branded TV dongle. It's HDMI. It has a remote, and they have dedicated YouTube and Netflix buttons, sort of like what you find on a Roku. But there's also a dedicated Google Assistant button. There seems to be some sort of a circular gesture nav area on the top, dedicated side volume buttons. So thankfully, we're going to have a Chromecast with a remote now and a dedicated UI. Jerry, what do you think about this change? I mean, Chromecast has basically been the same for the last 3 years since the Ultra was released. Why now? Why add a $70 Chromecast that actually runs Android TV now?
I don't know why, but I'm glad they did it. I'm probably in the minority, but I hate using my phone for media controls. I'd much rather use a remote. I have a Chromecast and a Shield TV plugged into my television. Guess which one I use all the time? Because one has a remote. That's what I use. It can't be a cost-saving measure because it costs more to make. It's going to cost more to buy than, you know, what you could pick up a Chromecast for like $1.99 with a fill-up at the Exxon station anymore. But it's a strange move because Google has always, you know, said about how great it is. Just hit a button and cast it from your phone. And now they're, okay, the Chromecast is dead. Long live the new Chromecast with a remote. And, you know, we might not even say Android TV. Who knows what we're going to call it? But here it is. It's awesome. Buy one.
I don't think Chromecast is going away, right? There's always going to be a market for something as simple as Chromecast currently is. I think it's much more likely it's going to be, you know, the existing Chromecast third gen or whatever it is by now will live on, and this will exist alongside it at a higher price for people who want that extra functionality.
That's what I said about Chromecast Music, and look where that got me.
Chromecast Audio.
Yeah. Well,
that's different because this is really what Google has shown over the last few years, that it's focused on visual media, right? They've done it with the Nest Hub and the Nest Hub Max. They've done it with, you know, releasing a new Chromecast. I think the fact that they updated the Chromecast but not the Chromecast Ultra says a lot about this product.
Yeah.
I think Alex is right. They keep the Chromecast at $35 and they release this to replace the Ultra at $70 or $80, whatever it ends up being. And this one just happens to come with a remote and Android TV. Or, as rumored, they are going to rebrand Android TV back to Google TV because why not? everything old is new again.
Yeah, the thing I'm most interested in, just because I'm a nerd for user interface elements, is how the screenshots we've seen from this device, it's going to basically do away with what we currently have with Android TV, and it's this completely redesigned interface that puts a much bigger focus on recommending like personalized content and integrating YouTube TV if you have it. I'm really curious to see if that's something that they push out as like a replacement for other Android TV devices, or if this is like some special UI that you only get on the Chromecast with Google TV, like how that's going to all play out.
I'm going to bet the latter, because if you remember, what we see now is thanks to NVIDIA, who refused to update the Shield TV until Google changed a bunch of stuff.
Right. Who has the power with when your only OEM partner is the one with the successful product, right? Google is actually introducing competition into the Android TV space here because it hasn't had any for 5 years, right? It's basically the NVIDIA Shield and then the Xiaomi Mi Box, but that's not really sold in the US either, plus all the disparate Android TVs themselves from companies like Sony, TCL is now making Android TVs, Hisense, and a couple of others. So yeah, that's really fascinating to me, is Google's strategy around releasing hardware powered with Android TV and also iterating on the platform itself. And Joe, just to your point, like, you know, you said Google, you know, this newer version of Android TV may be optimized for YouTube TV, but how many markets is YouTube TV available in, right? It's in the US, and that's basically it. So it's not exactly a widely available product around the world.
Is it in Canada?
No, we don't have any. These sort of over the top TV streaming services, we don't have. We basically have three of them, and they're mostly owned by the companies, the cable companies that already distribute cable boxes. So there's not a ton of competition here.
Yeah, like from what we've seen, like the YouTube TV is just like, it's integrated. It's one of the top pages that like make up the main navigation. So if they do sell in other markets, I'm assuming they just take that out of there, or they leave it for just US. But yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but that will be interesting to see like how widely they make this available, or if they launch as part of like a YouTube TV expansion, or yeah, I don't know what's going to come of that, but it's definitely interesting.
They'll only sell this thing in the US. That's my prediction.
That'd be very Google.
I would dispute that.
I know. I'm just
I don't think that's going to happen. But I wouldn't be surprised if there are some US specific features that launch on it. So that would not be beyond
Joe's
the pale.
Dog agrees.
Yeah, Damon agrees. He likes Android TV. All right, let's keep it going. We'll end the show with some PlayStation 5 news. Obviously, Android Central was all over this earlier in the week. PlayStation 5 announcement, release date November 12th, pricing $499 for the disc version and $399 for the digital edition. Who wants to talk about this? We had Russell Holly on last week to talk about Xbox, but we do a lot more PlayStation content on here. Jerry, you're a gamer. What do you think about the PS5?
I'd like to get one. It's a little out of my price range right now, even the digital edition, which I would never buy. If I can't get it on a disc, I don't want it.
Is this a bad time to tell you I would buy the digital edition?
I want to actually own the things I pay for. I don't want some cloud company who may decide to tell me to F off a year from now to own the things I paid for. My PlayStation 4 blew up last summer. It had a long run. I'll tell you that, but it finally gave up the ghost, and I never got around to replacing it. This makes me kind of glad I didn't, because there's no way I could justify buying a PS5 if I had just replaced my PS4. And this looks powerful enough for me to enjoy it. I was losing interest in my PlayStation 4 when I got a computer that could game in 4K. And the PlayStation 4 says it can game in 4K, but it's a choppy, nasty mess. I'm sorry, fans. It's a mess. This looks like it would be powerful enough to plug into this fancy monitor I have here on my desk, and if nothing else, game fast in 2K, which would be great because PlayStation has a lot of titles I'd like to play. If they had match the Xbox on price, I think there would have been even more, you know, fanatic fever on the internet than there was the way they had done it now. That's really right. all I know.
I'm honestly really surprised they went as low as $399, just because with like the Xbox Series S, it's discless the way the PS4 digital edition is, but the Series S also has lesser internals than the Series X, whereas the PS5 models, like, they're the exact same hardware. It's just that all-digital model doesn't have the disk drive. So I was kind of banking on, like, maybe a $50 price decrease. So the fact that it's a full $100 less, I thought was... It's impressive for me. Obviously, like, parents shopping this Christmas for a new console for their kids, $299 is still cheaper for a next-gen console than $399.
Oh, yeah.
For the spec nerd in me, I was impressed to see it's $100 cheaper in the same hardware across the board.
I guess I just can't help but remember, what was it? I think it was the original PlayStation. Right after the Dreamcast pricing was announced, the head of PlayStation development for Sony came out on stage and he looked at the audience and he said $2.99 and he dropped the microphone on the floor and walked off. That was his entire presentation. And, you know, there wasn't the fever pitch on the internet for gaming that there is now, but everybody just went wild over that. And had Sony done something similar, or hell, just done the same thing, come out and announce it even a dollar cheaper and that's all you say, you think the pre-order mess was bad now. Imagine that.
I think it's going to be interesting to see how that price gap might be made up later. So for example, you know, you're obviously locked into buying games through one source.
Right.
You get the discless version. So you may well end up repaying that $100 several times over throughout a console generation by not being able to take advantage of, you know, disc copies going on sale, you know, cheap pre-owned, wherever.
You know what, though? In the long run, it's not going to matter. The PlayStation 5 is going to outsell any Xbox just because of the gaming catalog and the way gamers are. They don't care if it's spend $100 more to get what they want.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So Xbox is really, I think Microsoft, we talked about this last week, they're being really smart about things. They're offering a ton of ways to buy the new Xboxes with the All Access, you know, bundle, essentially, to your contract. You buy you buy Game Pass Ultimate and you get a hardware thrown in there, basically, and you pay it off after 2 years and that's it. Really good deal. You end up paying less for the hardware as a result. But the game situation is very different. There's not a ton that's coming to the Xbox Series X and S that are not coming to the Xbox One S and One X, at least that from what we can tell. However, Sony also kind of went back on that promise to only release next-gen games on its PS5 by saying things like Horizon Forbidden West is indeed coming to the PS4 Pro in addition to the PS5, a couple of other games as well. So what's your take there? I mean, if you're a PS4 owner or a PS4 Pro owner, is this a must upgrade console for you, or is it just wait it out, wait until the next gen games are better, wait until the exclusives are there, like, you know, the ones that everybody's been waiting for? Or is there enough at the beginning to really justify those exclusives and to upgrade?
First off, I wouldn't do anything until I see a PlayStation 5 VR. VR games, you may love them, you may hate them, but you can't play them if you don't have a setup that works. And nobody thinks that the PlayStation 4 VR equipment is going to work with the 5. It might not.
They've said it have. You're going to need an adapter for the camera, but it is going to work with the PlayStation 5.
Well, work is like Android apps work on a Chromebook. You know, I may actually be a good experience, because PlayStation 4 VR is pretty good if you like VR. But if I had just bought a new PlayStation 4, especially the Pro, man, I would have to wait until I saw an exclusive that wasn't coming to me that I really, really wanted before I would even start to want a PlayStation 5. I want it because of the, you know, stronger internals that'll make it run at higher resolutions a little bit better. But if I have a PS4 Pro and I'm happy with that, that takes that out of the equation, and it would be about the games for me.
Yeah, that's kind of the boat I've found myself in after this whole event, because I've got a PS4 Pro and an Xbox One S, and the big PS5 game I was waiting for is that Spider-Man Miles Morales, and now that I know that's going to run the Pro, like, that defeats my need to upgrade. So my route now is probably get the Series X, just because I know all the games on Game Pass that I still have to play are going to run and look better on that. So I actually
Android streaming, right? Like, the Xbox Game Pass for Android launched this Tuesday. I went off without a hitch from what I can tell because of that long beta program. And the fact that it's not going to come to iOS anytime soon, it really is a compelling reason to subscribe to Game Pass Ultimate.
Yeah, I played some Gears 5 multiplayer on that, on the Tab S7, and a couple instances where it'll freeze up for a bit and then catch up, but for like 98% of the time you play it, it's as good as playing those on TV, like as far as I can perceive. I'm sure some people aren't going to be able to put up with the latency or whatever if you're more sensitive to that. But the fact that it's included at no extra cost if you're already paying for Game Pass Ultimate is like a ridiculous value add-on. Because like that, I'm sorry, Stadia, but that it makes the argument for that a lot more difficult from Google's side of things. Not that there was an argument in the first place, but
on the PlayStation side, you have to own the game and turn your PlayStation on to be able to play games on your phone. So mm-hmm. there's a huge difference there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, also the fact that they're increasing game. So there's two sides of this too, right? $70 games. That's a $10 increase over the previous gen, but I think it's totally justified just given the amount of money spent on game development and paying people fair wages. You know, there's been a ton yep. of reckoning about that. However, Xbox Game Pass really undermines that $70 price per game when you get so much value for your $15 a month. And Microsoft has committed to most of its first party or all of its first party titles and an mm-hmm. EA, you know, EA game, what's it called? EA Play games coming to Game Pass on day one, plus a bunch of other third party titles. That's a lot of value for $15 a month. That's the Netflix of gaming. It really makes sense if you're a varied gamer, right? If you play different genres and you just like to jump from title to title, I think that's way more compelling. Now, Sony did answer that to some extent by saying that on day one for your PS5 purchase, a bunch of PS4 classic games will be available if you are a PS Plus subscriber. Joe, what did you think of that announcement? Because I actually, I liked some of those games, but there didn't seem to be a hero title there to really compel me to be like, yes, that's the backward compatibility that I want out of my PS5.
Yeah, it is nowhere near the Game Pass alternative or competitor I was kind of hoping they would come out with, especially like if you've had a PlayStation 4 for any amount of its life cycle and you've had a PlayStation Plus subscription. Like, I would say half of those games that are with that PlayStation Plus collection have been given away for free at some point. So, like, if you've had a PS5 for, like, a year or two, like, there's a good chance you already own some of those titles that Sony's given away throughout the months that they do with their free couple of games.
Apples and oranges, though. PS Plus is more for multiplayer stuff. That they don't bill that as a, you know, look at all the free games you get to play this month. I mean, they do offer a few, but it's nowhere near what Microsoft does with, you know, they go all out with giving you content for your subscription, whereas PlayStation uses that subscription as a firewall. Hey, if you really want to play multiplayer games and have fun with, you know, other people that you know, you're going to have to get PS Plus. So,
and I have to imagine, like, within the next year or so, they find a way to combine that with PlayStation Now and have something similar. But, like, as of right now, it's pretty disappointing. And I wasn't expecting a full Game Pass solution, like, this early on. But it feels just kind of like, here's a little something extra while we're trying to build up something to compete with. And it feels like kind of throwing a bone that it's something there, but it's not the compelling reason to get it. But again, I don't think we were expecting to have that already from Sony, but it's a thing.
It did seem a little thrown together, I'll be honest. It felt like they just found a bunch of games that they could license and throw in for day one. But I have no doubt that at some point they're going to have to answer the Game Pass Ultimate lobby, because my goodness, is that good value if you are a gamer?
Nintendo should just make a new GameCube and just release the entire Mario catalog and just put both companies out of business. Do it, Nintendo.
There you go.
Well, we know what the reason Hayato is not here is not because he's editing video, as he says. It's because he's playing Mario All-Stars right now.
Yeah.
That is not any surprise. He's been talking about that since the announcement. All right, let's end this discussion and talk quickly about what is making us happy this week. As we end the show every week, it makes me happy to talk about what everybody else finds happy or is making everybody else happy. So, Alex, we will start with you. What is making you happy this week?
I've been going from very new gaming consoles to very old ones. I've been, on a whim, sort of installed a Genesis slash Sega Mega Drive emulator on some of my phones this week. So I've been getting reacquainted with some games from the 90s, currently replaying Sonic 3 and Knuckles. So that's been a bit of a blast in the past.
That's a great game. I loved that game. How does it feel playing Knuckles after all these years?
It's a little bit weird. I'm with the emulator I'm using, md.emu, the touch controls actually work better than you would think. It's pretty responsive, and of course, you know, modern Android phone has no trouble emulating a console from 30 years ago, so it's a pretty good experience.
I wanted to get Raymond Wong from the input here this week, because not the input. Am I saying the right thing? He wrote a big piece about the emulation experience on the Surface Duo and how it was just amazing. And there's just something really comforting about playing emulated games on a screen that looks like that, where you can basically put the controls on the bottom and just play the game like a Nintendo DS. I haven't tried it yet, but it just looks fantastic, and I really want to hear the experience. But you should buy a Bluetooth controller, Alex, and make it or even get one of those Genesis looking like old retro controllers. That would take it to the next level.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Joe, what's making you happy this week?
Mine's kind of a two-parter, and I think the first half is stolen from Hayato looking at our old spreadsheet notes in here. The first is cold weather, because we're finally getting like 60 degree Fahrenheit temps during the day and 30 or 40 at night, which makes me very, very happy as someone that despises blistering heat that we've had in Michigan for the past couple months. And naturally with that, my wife Kennedy, who is a Halloween aficionado who likes making this time of year like spooky season as much as we can, we've been watching a lot of horror movies and TV shows. She introduced me to Trick or Treat for the first time, which I had never seen somehow, and absolutely fell in love with it. And we've been going through Haunting of Hill House finally on Netflix, which has made me overly stressed and mortified at some parts, but I absolutely love that. It's some of like the best modern horror I think I've seen in a long time, and it makes me very, very excited for Bly Manor season that's coming out next month. So shaking your head disapprovingly.
All I can say to that is nope. I want nothing to do with it, but I'm very happy that you're getting joy out of it. All right, Jerry, what's making you happy this week?
I can go back outside and barbecue. And when I say barbecue, I mean slap a pork shoulder in a stove that'll take a big chunk of oak and let it cook for an entire day. When it's 105 degrees outside, you can't do that. But I can do it now, and I've already done it twice this week, and this weekend I'm doing it twice again. And this, I'm not a good cook, but I am great at smoking a big piece of meat. So this is my time to shine. This until Thanksgiving turkey, and then I'm done again until spring.
I'm jealous, because I think I'm more with Joe, where it got really cold really quickly, and being outside to barbecue in any condition now is actually kind of unpleasant.
Well, this you would like. Smoking is different. You prepare. You take a couple hours to make sure you've got enough wood gathered up, and you prepare your meat. You rub it down. You let it rest. Then you get everything in there, get it going, get the temperature around 225, 230 degrees. And then you just disappear. Your little gizmo will beep when the temperature drops too low, and you go back outside and put another piece of wood in it. And that's it. There's no babysitting it. I think that's why I like it so much.
Yeah, I could deal with that, with some beer, maybe.
Lots of beer.
A good porch chair. Yeah, I could get used to that. All right, that doesn't sound so bad. I'm in. I'll be there in a few hours.
All right. I've got two porch chairs.
Well, what's making me happy this week is Ted Lasso. It is a show on Apple TV Plus. I discovered it because I got Apple TV Plus with something. I don't know what, but I got it for a year. Most Apple users have a year free when they launched it last year or earlier this year, I think. It's a half hour show by Jason Sudeikis and Bill Lawrence. Bill Lawrence, obviously, famous from Scrubs, one of my favorite shows. He was also involved in Clone High, Spin City, and a bunch of other TV shows and movies. I like this a lot. It's a really easy half hour. It's very cute and funny, but it's, you know, it's heartfelt. If you liked the tone of Scrubs, which I know, Joe, you're a big fan, you will like Ted Lasso. Jason Sudeikis just plays him, you know, plays Ted Lasso not as a naive buffoon who just happens to be really optimistic and happy, but really somebody who like tries actively to be a happy and optimistic person and tries to make those around him feel better about themselves. Obviously, he's the story is that he's a college football coach who's found a lot of success, who is then hired as a coach for a middle of the road football, which is soccer to Americans, coach in somewhere in the UK. This is a very kind of middle of the road team, hasn't had a ton of success, and the management is trying to shake things up a little bit. It's worth your 5 hours. It's 10 episodes at half an hour each, and it is just a lot of fun. So if you can find it, do it. You know, don't go out of your way for it, but I would highly recommend it if you have access to Apple TV Plus.
You might have me confused with other resident millennial Hayato, because I've actually never seen Scrubs, but I've been meaning to for a long time, and this does sound really good. So regardless, I'll still probably check it out.
I think I don't know why. I just have it in your mind, in my mind, that you've like said many positive things about Scrubs, but maybe it was somebody else on the team. Anyway, yes, you should watch it. It's fun. It's also like 9 seasons, whereas Ted Lasso is 10 episodes, so it's much less of a commitment.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is our show for the week. Thank you, Alex, Joe, Jerry. It's been a pleasure as always. You can find Joe at JoeMaring1. You can find Alex at AlexDobie. You can find Jerry at GB Hill. You can find me at JourneyDan. You can find all of us at Android Central. Send us email, podcast@AndroidCentral.com. We love hearing from you. Lots of stuff on the docket for next week. It's going to be another very, very busy news heavy week. So join us again. And until then, have a great time. We will see you then. Bye-bye.
See you later.
See ya.
Toodaloo, buckaroo.